The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets
and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Johnny B. Goode, the host of the podcast Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon. This podcast dives deep into the story of Ray Trapani and his company, CentraTech. I'll explore how 320-somethings built a company out of lies, deceit, and greed.
I've been saying since a very young age that I was going to be a millionaire. If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
Listen to Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
A few years ago, John and I were talking to Donald Triplett's brother, Oliver, about his family's roots in Forest, Mississippi.
My grandfather, J.R. McCravey, was born in Tate County, Mississippi, in 1866. And he grew up on a farm in really abject poverty, but had a mind for banking and was working in a small bank in Senatobia. And there met Major Millsaps, who was a big philanthropist and entrepreneur in Jackson. And they hit it off real well, even though the major was 33 years older than my granddaddy. And he made a proposition to him that if he would put up some of his money, that he'd match it in several other business associates to form a bank in Forest, Mississippi, which my granddaddy jumped at the opportunity. So it was incorporated down here in March of 1900.
The McCraveys. Now that is Mary's side of the family. And Mary, again, is Donald Triplett's mother. Beeman Triplett, Donald's dad, and of course Oliver's dad, also came from a prominent family. His father served as the mayor of Forest from 1918 to 1920.
And Beeman Triplett, Donald and Oliver's dad, became an immense presence in town.
And it wasn't just that Yale Law School graduates were hard to find in small town Mississippi.
He was one of those guys, I never saw a photo of him when he didn't have a tie on. And he had a very Atticus Finch quality about him, I think.
That's Sid Salter. He's a journalist and a historian.
And actually kind of a local legend himself.
Don's father was one of the pillars of the community, a highly respected, very well-educated, well-traveled individual whose counsel, outside of legal representation, but whose counsel on many things was valued. He was a longtime Sunday school teacher and had a great deal of knowledge of the Bible, which was respected.
Beeman and Mary Triplett had money, and they had tremendous influence around the town of Forest. For more than 50 years, they were kind of a fixture in the Scott County Times society pages. They held key leadership positions in things like the Rotary Club and the Girl Scouts and the Garden Club and the local Methodist Church, where they also both sang in the choir.
They helped run the PTA, the public library, and the town legislative committee. Beeman traveled all around the South as a delegate for the Mississippi State Bar.
He was friendly with and respected by the mayor and the judges and the police and the local clergy and the publisher of the local newspaper. Pretty much everybody in town knew and respected Beeman Triplett.
Here's Sid Salter again.
In general society in America, people remember where they were when Kennedy was assassinated and 9/11 and all these things. In this community, one of the seminal events was when Mr. Beeman was killed in an auto accident because it was such a shock and such an impact on the community. So I think all of that kind of contributed to the fact that there was a protective feeling for Don. But, you know, your father's reputation only gets you so far.
Forrest was not actually the scene of much of the physical violence that Mississippi as a state became infamous for during the civil rights struggle, you know, the lynchings and all of that. At the same time, it can't be entirely exonerated of its past as a place with separate water fountains and separate schools and certain assumptions about who counted and who didn't. And that's interesting because Donald came of age in an era when there was not a lot of tolerance for people who were different or who were judged to be in some way inferior. Of course, the most egregious example of that was the Jim Crow system that ruled the South during Donald's childhood there and well into his adulthood.
The whole discussion begs the question of, had Don's family not had the bank, if there had not been the respect for Mr. Beeman Triplett that the community had, would Don's life have turned out the same way?
So it's also got to be said that one challenge Donald never faced as a person with autism was being a Black person with autism.
Because autism and race, they have their own tangled history.
For iHeart Podcasts, I'm John Donvan.
And I'm Karen Zucker.
This is Autism's First Child, an iHeart original podcast.
Episode 4. See the Forest.
Forest, Mississippi is located in the middle of the state. It's about 45 minutes east of Jackson, the capital. Here's Sid.
Particularly in the 40s and 50s, you had the burgeoning Mississippi poultry industry. The largest cash crop in Mississippi is poultry and eggs. It gave rise to 1.5 poultry processing companies and vertical integrators. And so you had this huge segment of people who worked in the poultry plants, either on the kill line or in cut up, but it's cold, difficult work even with automation. So you had that, you had a clock factory, a Sunbeam clock factory here for a portion of that time. The building later was taken over by Hughes Aircraft and now Raytheon, but it was a blue-collar, pretty heavy agribusiness town.
But let's back up for a moment to talk about how we met Sid. So after we confirmed that Donald was the child referred to as case number one in the early medical literature about autism, we reached out to Sid Salter because some of our research told us that he was a close friend of the family.
And we had a long conversation with him. We asked if he'd introduce us to Donald, and Sid agreed, but first said something quite revealing. He said if we hurt Don in any way, he would make sure we'd pay for it.
And you remember the email he wrote to us when we said we were going to treat Donald well? I've got it right here. He said, "If you are not as good as your word, I will use every means available to me to expose that fact, and I will make it my mission in life to discredit what you're doing." Wow. And Sid wasn't the only person in Forrest we heard that kind of thing from.
Yeah, and it came from a kind of love for Donald.
Yeah, it was a desire to protect him. And yes, it was love, and it was community-wide.
I came to Forrest in 1983 as a very young publisher of the Scott County Times, the local newspaper. Don was, by that time, pretty well ensconced in his role at Bank of Forrest. And as I came to know the town and the townspeople, Don was one of the characters that I met.
Donald made a powerful impression on Sid. He'd never met anyone quite like him.
Well, as a writer, I think what I see in Don is the absolute lack of nuance. Don experiences things at face value, and he doesn't appear to attempt to assign motives or to judge the depth of one's relationship. He just accepts things at face value, both his contributions to it and what he receives from others. And that is a remarkable quality because I think all of us go through life, even with exchanges as benign as an encounter with a store clerk, we all go, you know, and we think about, am I being treated well? Am I not being treated well? Are they talking down to me? Don doesn't experience the world in that way.
Sid was just a starting point, In Forest, we met a community full of people who consider Donald a friend, like Celeste Slay.
You can't help but like him, love him. He grew up here, he went to school here. I mean, everybody loved him because he was special, because he was different.
My wife was in the hospital twice, two or three times. One nurse was from Sebastopol, Mississippi, about 20 miles from Forest. I mentioned Don. Oh, we know, we love Don. Another nurse was from Lake, Mississippi. Oh, we love Don. He's our most famous personage. And they said, oh, I've known him all my life. And we're so proud to have him.
That is Reverend Brister Ware, who has known Donald since they were in college together. Many of the people we met in Forest have known Donald for decades. Here is Celeste Lay again.
I don't remember not knowing Don. He's always been a member of the Forest Presbyterian Church, and so was I. I remember when I was little, he always gave the Sunday school report. And he would tell how many people came to Sunday school and how many people were in church. And he would tell how much offering was given during the Sunday school hour. So I remember that as a child. He was just a permanent figure. You know, he was just always around. We never thought he was unusual. I mean, we knew he was a little different.
For a man with autism, life in a small community in Mississippi had a lot of advantages. It was predictable. It was tranquil. It was safe. Anyone living there could be confident that one day would be very much like the next.
Everyone knew everyone else.
After graduating high school in 1953, Donald packed his bags for East Central Community College. The school was about 40 minutes from Forest. And Don would not be the only new student from Forest going there, however.
Remember John Rushing, the teenage football star who looked after Don in high school? We met him in the last episode. Well, he was headed to East Central on a football scholarship.
Not that I was a hero or anything, but I tried to protect him, and Mr. Trippett knew that. So he called me and told me that Don was going off to school, which I already knew, and asked me, would I like to ride up there with them? I said, yes, be glad to, and so he took us up there. At some point, he didn't specifically say, I want you to do this, this, this. He says, I know you will look out for Don. I was glad to do it. Don was, he followed me around everywhere we went on campus, which I was, that was fine with me, you know, it didn't bother me.
But Donald got along so well at East Central that, in fact, he never needed John's help.
Donald really threw himself into the college experience. He joined a dozen clubs. He found a whole new community there. Once again, Donald's grades were mediocre, and it took him 3 years to graduate instead of the 2 years it usually takes to finish junior college. But he thrived socially. In fact, we found an old news clipping from 1955 that shows Donald with a handful of other students. The headline? Class favorites.
A few months after he got his associate's degree in liberal arts at East Central, Donald enrolled at Millsaps College in Jackson, Mississippi. Donald, as usual, moved along at Millsaps College at his own pace. It took him 3 years to graduate instead of two. But he got his diploma, and he went back to Forest, moved back into his parents' house, and took up residence in the same bedroom he grew up in.
When we return, Donald enters the workforce.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
Western nations like the U.S. and Europe.
Mexico will likely have its first female president.
And then you have China.
And help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters.
He'll get his yo-yos to Europe in time. But the longer this drags on, the more worry he's getting.
They knew that they needed to do this as fast as they possibly could to get a drug on the market as fast as they could.
I'm David Gura.
I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen. We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets.
Basically, everyone was expecting, if not a calamity, certainly a recession.
But the problem is that that paperwork, as our reporting showed, is fake.
As someone who's covering the market, I'm often very worried about an imminent collapse. So I'm thinking about it quite often.
Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
My name is Johnny B. Goode, and I'm the host of the new podcast, Creating a Con, the story of BitCon. Over this 9-part series, I'll explore the life and crimes of my best friend, Ray Trapani.
I always wanted to be a criminal.
If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
You see, Ray has this unique ability to find loopholes and exploit them.
They collected $30 million. There were headlines about it.
His company, Centratech, was one of the hottest crypto startups in 2017. It was going to change the world, until it didn't.
I came into my office, opened my email, and the subject heading was FBI request.
It was only a matter of time before the truth came out.
You can only fake it till you make it for so long before they find out that your Harvard degree is not so crimson.
How could you sit there and do something that you know will objectively cause more harm in the world?
Listen to Creating a Con, the story of Bitcoin, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's not totally clear what role Donald's family connections might have played in his admissions to Millsaps College, since his family was so well connected there. It is clear, however, that his name had everything to do with his getting and keeping a job after he graduated.
Donald's family, they had plenty of money. He didn't need to work, but he took a job at the bank in 1958. That job was part of the life that Marion Beeman would determine Donald be able to live.
He just brightens our day. I mean, he comes to the bank every day at 2 o'clock, you know, makes his rounds. He has a special name for everybody. Mine is Celestial Celeste. He's always called me that.
Hey, Shelby Welby. Hey, Nat the Cat. Hey, RC.
Hey, Don.
Hey, KH.
Hey, Don.
Hey, RF. Hey, Big Debbie.
Hello, how are you doing?
All right.
Good to see you.
Good to see you, too. Hey, Tricky Nick.
How are you?
All right. Hey, Jan with a plan.
Hey, Don, darling. Yeah, how are you?
All right, I got somebody filming me this time.
Okay.
He's good at telling jokes, you know, he makes little funny remarks. He'll say, hey, Celeste, I don't care what Denise says about you. You know, I like you anyway.
Hey, Denise, darling. You all right? You all right, Denise? I don't care what Jan said about you.
It had to be good.
Yeah, it had to be good.
This bank, which Donald's family owned, was part of the fabric of the community.
In 1927, the greatest natural disaster yet to hit the United States happened in the Great Flood of 1927. And within 6 months, 1/4 of all the land in Mississippi was sold for taxes. And so 1927, the stock market crash in 1929, the beginning of the Dust Bowl in 1930, all of these economic forces came about. The bank survived all of that and was an anchor in the community. I think the combination of the bank, of the respect that his family had earned, went a long way toward the community realizing that here's this family with a great deal of stature in the community who have a son that's causing them a great deal of struggle. And you don't keep secrets in small towns. There was general knowledge that they had gone to Baltimore and had sought extraordinary help for him. And in the initial stages, it didn't appear to be going very well, and they were having to make hard decisions. And I think the community respected that.
I actually moved here in December of 1979, hired by Bill McCravey, who would have been Don's uncle. That would be Don's mother's brother. And actually hired to come in as chief executive officer at the time. Just, you know, everybody falls in love with Don almost immediately. He's just such a genuine guy. And, you know, the longer we were together, the more we understood each other and relate. And, you know, he was always DT and I was always GW. You know, that was basically it.
That's Gene Walker. He was hired to run the Bank of Forest.
And at that time, Don was helping out in bookkeeping, doing statements and collecting the mail and those type things. But that was my first association with Don.
Donald's uncle, who of course was one of the bank's owners, had a special request for Gene.
Early on, he kind of explained Don's situation, and he made the statement to me, "Gene, I always will appreciate you if you'll have a place for Don." And, you know, always did. And the customers accepted him, the community obviously accepted him, and just I have always considered him an asset to the bank.
So what that granted to Donald was a job he could never be fired from, a job for life.
One of Donald's first jobs was as a teller, and when people came into the bank, he'd greet them by their account number. He'd say, "Hi, 9654321, your balance is $476. So that job didn't really turn out that well. But the gift was that Donald was allowed to make mistakes until he found the job that was the right fit.
And that goes a long way to really accommodating the challenges that a person's disability might present in the workplace.
And being accommodated in the workplace is still really rare for people on the spectrum. But Donald shows us how good it can be for everybody when the effort is made. He did his job at the bank. He found a whole new community there. They gave him friendship and he gave it back.
We talked with a lot of people who were in school with Donald back in the 1930s and 40s and 50s, all the way through to college. And the thing that everybody told us when we would ask stories about Donald,
they would always say, "Well, you know, he's kind of a genius." And that was the idea that really stuck to Donald.
I think the mistake people make when they first encounter Don is that there's some impairment of his intelligence. That's absolutely not the case. But in conversation, he's going to come at almost everything from the side. He doesn't discuss feelings. Not going to be a lot of eye contact. You get short snippets of very direct, sometimes brutally honest answers, but it's just how he processes information.
We saw this happening in a conversation with Donald one afternoon when Karen asked him about his father's death.
Do you remember the day that your dad was in the car accident?
Yeah, I sure did. I was in 1980.
How was your mom?
She was all right. She accepted that tragedy.
Do you remember, Don, what your dad was like?
Yeah, that's right. I remember how tall he was. He had white hair and was about 5'8".
What about your mom?
She was 2 inches shorter, 2 or 3 inches shorter. Her hair turned gray, too, just like he.
Can you tell me anything else about her?
No, not a whole lot.
One thing we always wondered about was Forrest being this really amazing exemplar of acceptance and tolerance during Donald's youth. Yet at the same time, in race terms, it practiced Jim Crow segregation.
Sid told us a story about that.
And I guess one story that best illustrates how race and civil rights transpired here, probably the most famous African-American citizen of Forrest was a blues singer named Alfred Big Boy Crudup.
Just for the record, Big Boy Crudup recorded under a few different names. His given name was actually Arthur.
There's a marker at that intersection now that outlines his life. But also very near that marker, Forrest had a really nice city pool. And travelers would invariably, north, south, east, west, they would see that beautiful pool. Probably the most pronounced demonstration of civil rights strife was the decision that the city made when Supreme Court decisions began to steer the use of public accommodations to open use and fairness to both races. Forrest did what a number of towns in Mississippi did. They'd simply got a backhoe and filled in the pool. And so you went from having this nice pool that they would rather cover up and not have access to than to integrate the use of the pool.
How do we reconcile, again, going back to the Jim Crow era, reconcile, you know, lovely women that we've interviewed saying, we're a small side of the town, we're just nice to each other, that's why we were nice to Donald, while at the same time the community had separate drinking fountains. What's our way to drop that?
Well, as I say, I grew up, you know, a county northeast in Neshoba County, which had some real racial atrocities, but I am of an age that I remember separate drinking fountains, separate waiting rooms in the doctor's offices. I remember my twin sister and I, every white kid would be seen by the doctor, even if you had a sniffle and you had a African-American child that was sicker, there was still that pecking order.
So, yeah, with a story like that, we find this seeming anomaly of acceptance and intolerance side by side in this little community back in the 1950s and 1960s. And yes, that tells us that things would have been very different for Donald growing up there if instead of being a white boy with autism, he'd been a black boy with autism.
Race has been tangled up with autism for a long time, and not just in Forrest, and not just in Mississippi, and not just in the South.
After the break, we'll hear how differently children of color with autism are treated compared with white children with autism, disparities which continue today.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
Western nations like the U.S. and Europe.
Mexico will likely have its first female president.
And then you have China.
And help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters.
He'll get his yo-yos to Europe in time. But the longer this drags on, the more worry he's getting.
They knew that they needed to do this as fast as they possibly could to get a drug on the market as fast as they could.
I'm David Gura.
I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets.
Basically, everyone was expecting, if not a calamity, certainly a recession.
But the problem is that that paperwork, as our reporting showed, is fake.
As someone who's covering the market, I'm often very worried about an imminent collapse. So I'm thinking about it quite often.
Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters.
It's an election year, so there's a lot of focus on the voters that TikTok is reaching.
The initial reaction is like, oh, things are looking so resilient.
I don't want to be too pessimistic, but I just don't see the political will down in Washington right now to change their tune.
I think the American electorate has been signaling that it expects a rematch of the 2020 election. These are unprecedented times.
With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
A lot has changed since Donald was a child, but there's no doubt that a black kid with autism growing up when Donald was young would have had nothing like his advantages, especially when it came to getting diagnosed in the first place.
And let's be very clear about this. It's not just the South. For black children, getting diagnosed with autism has always been a challenge. When Karen and I started looking at old documentaries about autism from the 1950s and 1960s, we noticed that almost all of the kids in these movies were white. And that's partly because for a long time, psychiatry had this idea that autistic children were only born to parents who were highly educated. And that belief was seen to rule out the possibility of an autism diagnosis for black children because their parents didn't have access to higher education. Total logical fallacy, but it ruled.
I think something to be considered about Donald Triplett is that he's in a homogenous space for him. Not meaning that black people don't exist in the same town, but meaning that his social circle was predominantly white. And he came from a family of a certain class, which means that the family had means and access and power.
That's Stephanie Parks. She studies anthropology and teaches it to undergraduates.
We can never talk about race without class. And for Donald Triplett, that meant that his parents were able to shape a group of people by saying, look at our very wealthy, powerful family who is doing whiteness extremely well, and we accept this child as he's perfectly beautifully made.
We were surprised to learn that she talks about Donald in her lectures, using the stories we've written about him.
Stephanie, we want to note, is African-American.
Now, a lot of this is personal for Stephanie. And the story she tells, her personal experience, is how hard it was to get her concerns about her son listened to.
So we always have to be careful about generalizing from any one person's experience. But what Stephanie was encountering fit a pattern that held for decades, where it was far more difficult for Black and Latino children in the U.S. to get a diagnosis of autism than it was for white children. Very recently, as in within the last year, that gap closed dramatically. And eventually, Stephanie's son, Dell, did get a diagnosis when he was 3. But she kept going with her work, trying to understand what's been driving this disparity.
My academic work stems directly from my own experience being a mother of a child with autism. I used to sit in our clinic during my son's therapies and wonder why we were one of the only Black families there. And that started a question that necessitated answers for me, and that meant taking my degree all the way to UCLA to get a PhD to answer it. I have always been interested in language and how we think about the world, but once my child was diagnosed, I started to understand that there were things happening in the clinic that seemed outside of our cultural norms as Black Americans. And that kind of set me on my path to think about how do clinics and hospitals function in a way that creates healthcare disparities? Is that about Black Americans' cultural ideas about medicine, or is that about the way in which biomedical clinics themselves work? There's a little bit of push and pull. I would say that a lot of the healthcare inequity is based on race and racism within biomedicine. And when Black American families have experienced this since the beginning of our time here on this continent, it also means that we have our own ideologies that exist as well about our safety and our well-being in those spaces. And I knew entering into medical space that those would be very, very important. But when I began my research, I was thoroughly shocked by how incredibly insidious racism is in these situations.
I asked Stephanie about some of the situations she's referring to, and she said that in many instances, they're not necessarily overt.
What are some of the examples of things that you saw?
I was watching a clinic in a major metropolitan area, and I think that's important because we often stereotype these areas as being more diverse. But in this particular observation, I watched several families go through an autism diagnostic process, and one of the Black parents was asked about disciplinary practices. She explained to the clinician how her child was doing things that had scared her. He would get a whooping so he would understand not to do them again. And the clinicians became very concerned and decided that this parent's response was concerning, and they wanted to call Child Protective Services. But the next appointment, we had a white family come in, and the child expressed having been hit by their parents in response to being naughty. In the situation of the white family, the clinicians framed her as being emotionally unavailable and needed help with resources such as respite care, you know, somebody to come in and give her a break and take care of the child while mom caught a break and refreshed herself. The child, the white child using the word spanking, the Black mother using the word whooping. They're two similar words, but ideologies about race, how we understand how people talk, right, makes a difference. And white clinicians looking at a Black mother using the word whooping necessitates a call to Child Protective Services, but a white child expressing having been spanked does not. And that's a problem.
Were those literally back-to-back?
Back-to-back appointments, yeah.
So that was one appointment.
It got to a point where Stephanie was seeing a therapist right after these sessions, just so she could leave her fear and frustration in a safe place.
because I couldn't take that home and then be an effective parent. I saw too much. And it was really, it scared me to my core when I saw it.
Stephanie shared a particularly powerful story about an experience she had with her son, Dell.
My son was modeling an autism diagnostic process for a group of graduate students that I happened to be a part of. And the clinician happened to ask him what he liked, and my son responded by saying, "I like big butts and I cannot lie," which is, if you're unfamiliar, a popular rap lyric that every 11-year-old in the country probably knows and laughs at. Well, the clinician laughed and they went on into the room. And once they got into the room, the clinician began reading a story. And if you're familiar with this particular test, there's a book that they bring out that has no words.
The idea is that the clinician and the child being assessed are supposed to go through the pages and create a story together.
And in the book, the sun is setting. And the clinician says, "The sun is setting." And my son sings, "Yes, it's going down for real," which is another popular lyric, especially at that point in time. But the clinician finally does something that's quite interesting. He code switches into black language and says, "Oh, I'm the best hip hop dancer ever. Drop the mic." And Dell just looks at him like he's a little funny. I know his intention was to try and build a bridge between him and Dell in any way possible, to be able to gain access, to make Dell comfortable and to have a conversation, right? And when we get to scoring the actual test, the clinician references the fact that Dell has used these rap lyrics and he calls them inappropriate, disruptive, and echolalic. And echolalic being a feature of autism that some people have where they echo back certain things. And it's true, that happens. But if the clinician knew Black culture better, he would have identified this as kind of one of our linguistic ways of being. So for us, what Dell was doing looked wonderful, like he was being culturally appropriate, which is what we want for him. But for the clinician, what it translated to was a different autism score. Not problematic for Dell in particular, given the way autism affects him, but for Black kids in particular, who bear the brunt of this massive autism inequity that we are facing. That kind of scoring process leads to something that could turn out to look like, oh, he has ADHD or another disorder that's not autism.
A clinical diagnosis is important, not only in understanding how to approach the treatment and services a child will receive, but without it, a child with autism will not have access to the many resources that are critical for them to be successful in the world.
When kids are mis- or underdiagnosed, and Black kids significantly more misdiagnosed, meaning a label that precludes them from getting access to services, medical or educational. Black children make up, I believe, 50% of our special education students. We don't make up 50% of the population. So while I'm telling you we are mis- and underdiagnosed, we are also overdiagnosed with things like learning disability and then placed into special education, when instead maybe it's not learning disability, maybe it is autism, and maybe they need different supports to help them succeed in these spaces, right?
A correct diagnosis has the potential to completely change the outcome of a person's life.
But for a correct diagnosis, the trajectory of a child changes immediately once you're placed in a classroom with your typically developing peers in a community of support surrounded by the correct services.
And what she found is that the experience that Black families have in a clinical setting isn't necessarily dependent on socioeconomic factors either.
Okay, so in my particular study, I'm an anthropologist and I study quite small. And so my master's degree work is a collection of about 20 families. They all have a bachelor's degree or above. They are all two-parent households with the exception of one. They are many military families. They basically meet all of the things that Black people have been told that if you do these things, you will have access to the American pie and the American dream will be yours too, right? They've done everything they can to get there. Their kids were still misdiagnosed. And one of the things that I aimed to challenge was this idea of just class. And so for my work, what I have found is that families' biggest identifier for if they're going to have trouble in a clinic, if they're going to fall into inequity, is if they show up and they're Black. If you are a Black person and you walk into a hospital, that's it. It doesn't matter how beautifully you think you speak English or what degree you have or how much money you have, how nice your home is. Nothing matters at this point.
Stephanie says what they're encountering is systemic racism.
They encounter racism, pure and simple. And again, this, we have to start thinking about racism quite differently. I know that we often think about racism in really big ways. Like, we think about it in terms of, like, you know, again, like the KKK or these big stereotypes. But the truth is that racism is incredibly powerful because it exists in these tiny, tiny spaces. And these families are encountering this.
And while a significant number of the clinicians doing the assessments and diagnoses are white, Stephanie feels there's more to it.
Stephanie says the inherent biases that come with the experiences she's describing aren't always so obvious in the way that many people might think about racist behavior.
I would also say that I have never walked into a clinic or watched a family get treatment or made an observation where I saw a clinician do anything other than the moral appropriate, what they believe to be the moral appropriate thing. But we do have to work incredibly hard about pulling apart race in these spaces. And that's going to take a lot of work and a lot of reflexivity on part of the clinician.
You know, of course, none of this relates to the life that Donald lived. And that's sort of the point of telling this story. And we have found when we speak with people who know a lot about autism, a lot about its history, about diagnoses, about the science behind it, that the reality that Stephanie's talking about, it still comes as a surprise to them.
On the next episode of Autism's First Child, Donald Triplett travels the world.
If you're enjoying Autism's First Child, help us spread the word with a rating on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Autism's First Child is a production of School of Humans and iHeart Podcasts, based on our book and our documentary film, In a Different Key. I'm John Donvan.
I'm Karen Zucker. The podcast is produced by Alexander Ritchie.
Written by Alex French, senior staff writer at iHeart Originals. Story editor is Matt Riddle. Editing and assembly by Karim Benyagoub. Original score composed and mixed by Elise McCoy. Scoring, mixing, and mastering by Ryan Peoples.
Special thanks to Sid Salter, Celeste Slay, Reverend Brister Ware, Gene Walker, Stephanie Parks, and all the people of Forest. And to Ray Conley, Ernie Indradat, and Will Pearson.
Executive producers are Virginia Prescott, Brandon Barr, Elsie Crowley, and Jason English.
School of Humans.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Johnny B. Goode, the host of the podcast Creating a Con, The Story of BitCon. This podcast dives deep into the story of Ray Trapani and his company, CentraTech. I'll explore how 320-somethings built a company out of lies, deceit, and greed.
I've been saying since a very young age that I was going to be a millionaire. If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
Listen to Creating a Con, the story of Bitcoin, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.